Welcome to Inside the Rope, the podcast where we speak to the leading minds in wealth management. I'm your host, David Clark. In this episode, I'm bringing you a conversation with Bridget Leckie. It's not often that we have people from Coda on the podcast. And in this episode, we've been successful in getting Bridget to come on the show after about 8 years of trying to get Bridget onto it. So it's fantastic to get her on. Bridget's the chief economist at Coda, and we talked to her about the recent performance of economies around the world. We also touch on her outlook for those economies around the world and how they may affect investment markets. We talk about specifically how artificial intelligence may affect those economies and how investors might want to think about that. We talk about the fact that over half the world's population are set to go to the polls in 2024, and in particular how the US elections may affect the US economy and the Federal Reserve's plans. We also talk about the two wars that are currently going on and how they may disrupt or how they may affect the economic situation and how investors are thinking about things. We round out that conversation with Bridget about a conversation and focus on various asset classes and the favoured asset classes of Bridget versus consensus in by the street at the moment. So please enjoy the podcast. I certainly did. Please continue to send me your feedback. You can email me at david.clark@codacapital.com. Please remember the podcast is recorded for informational and education entertainment purposes only. People are reminded to seek advice, read any offer documents, information memorandums, and to listen to the disclaimer at the end of the podcast. Enjoy the episode. Bridget Leckie, welcome to Inside the Rope.
Thank you, David.
It's been a while in the making, this one. I'm going to say about 8 years, but it's great to finally kick off and get you on the podcast.
Lovely to be here. And you're right, it's taken a while.
Can we perhaps kick away, as we like to do, is if I can ask you to introduce yourself to the listeners.
So my name is Bridget Leckie. I've had 30 years experience in financial markets. Currently, I'm the chief economist of Coda Capital, but I've had roles spreading across investment banking, private wealth, across in broking, as well as funds management, as well as government. So it's right across the finance sector.
And what do you think were the most influential in your career to date of those roles?
I guess the whole lot, truthfully. I think right in the early stages, I was extremely lucky to be in New Zealand government right at the time of the major reforms. So they were the reforms that were really unravelling what happened in the Muldoon area. So this was coming back in the early 1990s. So as a so-called geek whiz kid, what you could do was basically look at what is wrong in the economy from a sort of textbook perspective. And it was the era of deregulation. So it's absolutely fantastic in terms of the couple of years that I had in Treasury in New Zealand. What I saw and what I was able to do was something you just wouldn't be able to do in 20 years.
Wow. Right place at the right time, as they say. And if people were to think about something from a personal side point, how would you describe yourself, Bridget?
Look, I decided I'm pretty driven.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I love financial markets. Admittedly, it's the first thing I do when I wake up. I should get out of bed. But what do I do? Read the overnight news and read markets first. So that's the tragic side of me. The other side of me is I enjoy playing golf. I enjoy doing aerial Pilates. So life is relatively full.
Well, I'm so happy I asked that question. Aerial Pilates. I don't even know what aerial Pilates is.
So it's a mixture of sort of trapeze work, and it's a mixture of being in doing a traditional Pilates, but being up in the air. The key thing to do with this, it's working on the core okay. strength.
They tell me that's good for you. And well, it sounds like a key person cover might have to be expanded there by the sound of that. So Bridget, let's get into it. Can you perhaps give us and the listeners a little recap of what's happened over the last, I don't know, 12, 18 months, 24 months in markets globally?
Absolutely. So let me start a little bit with just the backdrop and then markets. So in terms of the backdrop, what we have seen is that growth has surprised in the US to the upside. So that's the first thing, is we've seen US economic resilience. So the back half of last year, US GDP growth was a tad over 4%. So that has been really a factor that I'd say virtually no one's got right, the degree of resilience, the degree of strength. And a lot of the reason behind that has just been the excess savings on the back of the pandemic and the lockdowns. Other parts of the world have not fared as well. So the back half of last year, Japan, Germany, the UK were all recorded in official recession. So when I say official recession, that means two consecutive negative quarters of GDP. Mm-hmm. So you may not feel like you're in recession because you can have still full employment, but that's the technical definition. The other part of this is inflation. We all know our cost of living's gone up. Inflation peaked, depending on what country you're looking at, around about late 2022, sort of looking at around about 8 to 9%. So these are levels we hadn't seen in over 30 years. So these numbers absolutely took a lot of people by surprise. But in the last year or so, inflation has pulled back. So we've had that pullback in inflation. What that in turn has done is enabled a rally in the bond market. Mm-hmm. That in turn has helped propel the mixture of inflation receding, the bond market rallying, in other words, bond prices, cost of capital falling, earnings being resilient because economies by and large have been okay, lower cost of capital, and growth has been okay despite, as I said to you, some technical numbers in the negatives. And that in turn has propelled equity markets to record highs. I mean, for example, on Friday, you saw the Nikkei at highs that have been not surpassed, literally, the ones we last saw in 1989. So wow. We've finally broken that one.
That's a long time between drinks, isn't it?
Huge time. They have not been able to get that, finally conquered it. And they've done that with a recession. So I sort of say to you, do those numbers really matter? Those companies have got earnings and it's the low cost of capital. Would you be chasing Japan at these levels? Look, probably going to go a bit higher, but no, it wouldn't be. I think there's still a lot of structural issues there. But to recap sort of the last 12 to 18 months, we've had economic resilience. I highlighted the growth side of it. What I perhaps didn't highlight is we've had full employment. So in other words, labour markets have been tight. Despite growth numbers, in terms of GDP numbers, the actual labour markets have been tight. So that's been a huge cushion. Because if you've got a job, then in reality, despite rising cost of living, you can sort of support it. And when you've had labour shortages, if your balance sheet is getting quite tight, people have actually been able to take a second job. So that's an enormous cushion, which is why I think we haven't seen this downward spiral. So what I think investors are looking for now, what's going to give in the sense of labour markets are tight, full employment, inflation's come down, growth is buoyant. A lot of I think with the exception of China, all the major markets are at record highs. Where to from here? And I think that's the key question.
It's a challenge. And you talked about a technical recession. There's been a bit of chatter about Australia being in a per capita recession. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So Australia's had quite good population growth. So that's why we look at it per capita. So this is where if I compare that to, say, Japan, which Japan being in a technical recession, I'd almost argue Japan is strong growth and Japan is probably no growth because of their demographics. So this is where you start getting cute in terms of being an economist and playing with the data. So that's why to some extent I'd say to you, David, the better way of flipping it around is actually looking at the labour market. Mm-hmm. Where is the unemployment rate? Is that at full levels? Because that is highlighting the economy is really growing at capacity. So I think without sort of confusing things here, you've got two parts. You've got structural and you've got cyclical. So with Australia having a pretty strong employment growth / population growth, obviously partly due to catch up with immigration. The US is the same. We are higher GDP or economic growth economies. That is why we use the per capita to try and sort of put that into context with Japan, which is going backwards. Germany's gone backwards. Same sort of thing. They've got pretty poor demographics and they haven't got the population, the growth, the demographics coming into play.
And Bridget, do you think, you know, there's a conversation going around inflation and if we're going to see these interest rate cuts coming from the Fed or maybe the RBA later in the year. There's a bit of discussion around what makes up that inflation and the fact that, yes, you might have seen some supply chains free up after COVID and, you know, people can get back to buying lumber for their renovations and new kitchen benchtops at more ordinary prices. But it seems that there's a degree of stickiness around wages. And if I even go back to my sort of, you know, high school economics and university economics in that, you know, wage push inflation. Once you get that into the system, the concept, and I think we've seen even in Australia, I want to say, you know, the ambulance people who are fantastic and obviously need to be remunerated well, but I think they've negotiated a 15% wage increase over the next 3 years. These people, once it's that paid to them, they tend to go out and spend that within the economy, and demand grows further in the economy and you get this wage push. Do you believe that this inflation is going to be a bit stickier, this last leg of it, and therefore it's going to be slower in terms of these interest rate decreases that we might see that the market's sort of factored in already?
Absolutely. So you're totally on the money there. If we break inflation down, goods inflation is now negative. So that's back in deflation. So we obviously, that area shot up. We all went and bought extra televisions. We were locked down, et cetera, mm-hmm. et cetera. So we overspent to some extent in that area.
New golf clubs, Bridget, I would have said.
We were locked out of the clubs, remember? The 5 kilometre rule.
Okay.
had to stand there in the backyard and try and swing and avoid your next door neighbour's fence and glass windows. So the good side is, as I said, is a negative because we've got those supply chains now operating and we've got pretty sort of, in some areas, weak demand. Mm-hmm. Where we've got inflation, and it's across virtually every developed market, is in the services side, which absolutely is coming from the labour market. That is tight, that's feeding through. And the other side that we've got inflation is, and this is probably more structural, and that's in rent and sheltering. And mm-hmm. that's a tricky one because there aren't any fixes. So what this means, inflation, the easy gains have occurred. So it was the fallout of energy price spike, obviously from geopolitical issues in Europe, compounded with what we saw in terms of just the whole disruption, supply chains from the pandemic, et cetera. And also because, think of ourselves in terms of, we had labour shortages because we had no immigration. So we've got through that. But now we're in the situation where we've still got this tightness. And I think a lot of it is structural. So are central banks going to get below or back to targets? I don't think so. I think this last mile is going to be the sticky one. I think where inflation is going to settle is above central bank target bands, but not alarmingly so. It's manageable, but it's not what we're used to. Another way of couching it would be to say, I think we're probably going back to levels that we saw in terms of inflation before the GFC. So maybe what we're doing here is just coming out of, we had the GFC, we never really fully recovered from that because it was a banking sector crisis. And maybe that's part of it. And then we got the pandemic on top. So now I think we're sort of unraveling a lot of this and going back to levels that are more sustainable. Because it keeps sort of coming back in terms of what we'd had since the 1990s was inflation and interest rates going lower and lower and lower. But at some point, we got too low. You know, negative interest rates just don't make sense to me. Never could. So we had to normalise. But I think our new normal is, or what do you want to call it, is going to be a bit higher. And that does alter the cost of capital, and we've got to reprice for that. And part of that's structural. Part of it is demographics. Part of it is the word that I call a lot of people to as well, deglobalisation. Mm-hmm. Part of it's energy transition. So there's a plethora of other factors at play, which I don't think are going away.
And Bridget, where's China been in this? I know if I look at equities markets, for instance, China's been pretty negative. I think off the back of a collapse in property. Can you tell us a little bit more and the listeners about what's been going on in China?
Look, China is quite a complex story. So you're absolutely 100% correct. China's been the outlier. The equity market has fallen significantly. It's down about 60% from its recent high. So the Chinese equity market has been totally beating to a different drum. Remember, though, the Chinese equity market is a momentum market and it's a retail market, so it doesn't have a lot of sort of sticky institutional money. So that's the first point that I'd emphasise. Secondly, absolutely, the property sector has been hit quite hard. But bear in mind, there's been a lot of, those of you that have been to China, particularly going out west, the amount of building that has been done has been absolutely phenomenal. Now, the positives are, if you go to some of these fourth, fifth, sixth tier cities, their airports, their infrastructure, absolutely fantastic. They're totally Rolls Royce. So they've made a wonderful job of them. But they've built to grow into. So most countries do it the other way around. They build to catch up. mm-hmm. whereas China's built ahead. So it's fast-forwarded a lot of its infrastructure. So the problem it's now getting into in terms of China, to some extent you could argue it's overbuilt. And the fallout of that is the local councils are struggling in terms of they need the land sales in order to fund, and they've basically got choked with debt, et cetera, et cetera. And Beijing has clamped down on the property side of it and the developers and access to capital. Remember, again, it's a market that's not totally free. It's regulated. The other side of it, remember that China also had very severe lockdowns. They lasted longer than anywhere else. And remember, too, China and the lockdowns, unlike what we had here in Australia and other countries had, didn't have the government subsidies. So the expectation was that when China came out of the lockdowns, you'd see significant pent-up demand. But because they didn't have the excess savings like other markets did, because people were stuck at home and they couldn't spend and were getting government handouts, you didn't get that big lift, which was expected. Now, confusing this or adding more complexity, remember, China's evolved. Gone are the days, even though the GDP numbers are always difficult in terms of interpretation, China is not a 7% GDP economy.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably about a 3 or 4. And that's because it's moved up the income ladder. So looking at China and analysing what it's done the last 10 or 15 years is not a good barometer as to what it's going to do in the next 10 to 15 years. And that is why when China entered the World Trade Organization, the idea was to get people up the ladder as quickly as possible in terms of get people to that middle income, get the savings buffer, get that wealth, get the education, et cetera, et cetera. Now the focus is very much on the quality of growth as opposed to the quantity. And I repeat myself, it's quality, i.e. the composition, not quantity. That's a shift. So absolutely, they had to do something about the overbuilding. They have. They're moving forward. So to answer your question, it's multifaceted, but from the equity market perspective, I think the Chinese equity market where it stands today is looking compelling vis-a-vis other markets that are either fully valued or expensive. China is looking quite cheap, quite interesting, but you've got to play that market via active on-the-ground managers because there's a lot of still low-quality stocks on that market, emphasising it's a retail momentum market.
And Bridget, the UK and Europe, rounding out our sort of round the world update on what's happened. How's the UK and Europe fared?
So the UK has not fared well, but remember, the UK is still suffering from Brexit. So that's a multi-year sort of workout as it rebuilds itself, as it weans itself off the EU and tries to work out more trade and its path forward. Europe is mixed. So look, simply put, those countries in Europe and developed Europe that are self-sufficient in energy, they've been doing all right. Those countries that are energy importers have not. So Germany is the one that's become under pressure because, one, it requires energy imports, and number two, it exports to China. So China being weak plus having to import energy has created issues for Germany. So Germany's been the one in recession. Look, there are some scant signs of improvement. The labour market data is a little bit better in Germany. But I would say to you, Germans have got excess savings. So they actually have erred on the side of conservatism. So there could be some pent-up demand that does come forward in the next 12 to 18 months. But broadly speaking, I said the rest has been okay. But if the US obviously does start to slow, then it would be a tough call to say that Europe will not be affected by that.
So let's change gears a little bit here, Bridget. We've done a great sort of synopsis there of around the world and what's happened. Let's talk about a little bit about your outlook and your view of what might happen in the future, which is, I know, tough, but let's give it a shot. And maybe if we could do that through a lens where we talk about a few things that seem to be stand out that may influence things. If we want to start with elections, for instance, and I think the year they're talking about something about, you know, over half the world's population is going to the polls. I think we've already had Indonesia, the world's largest democracy, go to the polls. I think we've got India going to the polls later this year. I think the UK might even as well. And then to throw it in, I think, what is it, the 4th or the 5th of November, we finish off with the US elections, which arguably are probably the most influential on markets. How do you see those elections affecting markets this year?
Oh, look, the big one is the US. Absolutely. That's the dominant one. I mean, you're already seeing the primaries, and where it stands right now, it looks like we will be seeing Trump going through. It'll be a Trump-Biden rematch. Mm-hmm. In terms of what does Trump take two look like, some would argue not that different to Biden. We're already hearing the tariffs. We're already hearing the tax side of it in terms of tax cuts, the pullback in the Inflation Reduction Act. So there will be some changes. It's just to what extent it increases the geopolitical side of it, and to what extent do you see heightened nationalisation? I think that's something we've got to take into account. Another thing we've got to take into account, which we'll touch on probably later in this discussion, and what does it mean for interest rates? Because there is potentially a scenario of this, and that is the Federal Reserve is forced to cut interest rates going into November and more aggressively than they want, and that's politically driven. So there are implications, I think, for the Federal Reserve. The chairman of the Federal Reserve, his term is due to expire, I think, is in 2026. But I'd say his role is clearly at risk under the Trump administration. So that's the area that does worry me from a market backdrop.
So he's going for Biden potentially, and therefore will want to cut rates to help Biden out going into those elections that will have, you know, serious implications for financial markets. Is that potentially something we could see?
It's possible, but I think I'd actually prefer to pull this back a little bit in terms of the short-term side of it, of interest rates and where they stand, because I think that's what happens, I think, in the next 6 months is going to drive what I just said to you. Mm-hmm. Because if we get no interest rate cuts and we're at where we are right now in terms of inflation growth, I think the hand would be pushed. By contrast, if we do get some interest rate cuts going into the election and things are okay, then conceivably, there's going to be less political pressure. So I think it's going to see how things pan out first.
It'll be very interesting to see how that plays out, in fact. Let's maybe change gears a little bit here and talk about artificial intelligence. It doesn't seem that you can go anywhere now, whether it's a latest venture capital raising or any company update and their annual review. Everything's being stated that, you know, they're an AI company or they have plans in that area. And in fact, we've been working on the last couple of months, you know, putting together a side note of podcasts as part of the series, diving into it, explaining to people what this technology actually is. And, you know, my take on it is that you're really talking about super high-powered, glorified spell check to the extent that, you know, Siri can predict what your next words are going to be, when it can remind you, because it sees your diary, how long the traffic is to the next place. You know, in basic terms, you've got an exponential amount of information out there now, and compute power has increased that they can mine this and use that data and that information to make predictive analysis to expedite, speed up our work and make us much more efficient or powerful. How do you think, or do you think, this is going to make a meaningful difference to the world's economy?
Look, I think AI is absolutely here to stay. And I think there are significant positives. There are also significant negatives. And I think the jury is still out in terms of when it's going to have significant economic and market impact. So when I look at the positives, positives to me are efficiency. And also, you can give other examples too. If you go like the ability to be able to look at the quality of the soil, that sort of thing, where you grow your vegetables. Now, that's a huge positive, that predictive analysis that you beautifully articulated, David. So that's a positive. And obviously, just efficiency in terms of you write things and the spell check and how you can potentially improve it. So that, again, is efficiency, and obviously what you can do creatively, that is efficient. The negative, obviously, is sort of, are the robots controlling us and who programs them? That's mm-hmm. that's the tricky one, because that actually gets into politics.
The misinformation.
Absolutely. And if we look back at autonomous cars, I mean, that's where they got sort of stuck in terms of who programs for the car is going off the off the cliff.
The ethics debate of you've got a brain surgeon in one car, on the other car you've got X, Y, Z, and who should you save and why, and does the person who pay more get more, et cetera?
So that's the tricky one. And then if you go through in terms of the actual impact of it. So it should be deflationary because it gets efficiency. It should be. But what I've seen is this. We know a revolution here is coming, but I want you to put it into context of go back and think about the internet, mm-hmm. think about your email, et cetera. We knew it was coming. You know, go back to the dot-com bubble when we had all those profitless tiny companies. So we knew we were on the cusp of this revolution, but we didn't quite know where it was going. And I'd argue it was a good 15 years before it really penetrated everywhere and we got the efficiency gains across the world. And we got that greater connectivity and that really gave us an nirvana of a backdrop from lower inflation, lower interest rates, and also higher equity returns. So it gave us that backdrop. So when we look at this, it's probably a good 10, 15 years away before it really does bite. It's probably like a 2030. The other thing I want to emphasize too, some areas are not going to be replicated by machine. I'll give you an example. Think of your garden. Think of like your courtyard with your weeds, etc. It's very, very difficult to get a robot to replicate the human hand, to actually physically be able to pick out the individual weeds. That's not going to work. You might be able to have your automated lawnmower, but in terms of your sort of lower skilled ends, it's proving to be very, very difficult. The higher end where you've got huge databases, that's where I see the efficiency. So agriculture, I think, is one that's a big winner outside of our own industry in terms of just the writing and that side of it.
It would seem that, you know, the revolution that is tainted to happen, you know, seems to be focused very much on a lot of lower end white collar workers, in a lot of the grunt work, if you'd like. What you're talking about there is the timing there takes me back to that sort of Bill Gates quote, I think it is, that we tend to overestimate what we're going to do or the changes that'll come in 2 years and underestimate what happens in 10 years. So, yeah, interesting that view on that, and it'll be fascinating to watch it how it plays out, particularly as we saw NVIDIA announce numbers and jump markedly within the last week. Next one, geopolitics. You know, I was sitting next to one of the advisors on the floor here talking to clients and, you know, they were at the end of last year's rally and everything was fantastic and he sort of opined to the client on the phone I could hear saying, well, yes, you know, everything's rallied, it looks fantastic, but, you know, 2024, we've got half the world's population going to the polls, we've got artificial intelligence being implemented, and we've got two wars going on in the world, nothing to worry about, right? So how do you think or will those two wars are likely to have any effect on sort of economic outlook and also where investors should be turning their focus to?
Look, I think these wars are absolutely a tragedy, but what they're doing, particularly in the case of the US, they're adding to some of the structural problems in the US. What I mean by that, the US, as I said to you earlier, is currently on the back half of last year, recorded GDP growth, economic growth in excess of 4% the back half of last year. But yet at the same time, you're running fiscal, which is government deficits, at crisis levels. In other words, at recessionary levels. That is not sustainable because you're adding to debt. Now, where this fits in with the wars and the geopolitics is the amount that's being spent on defence. So what worries me from a macro and market perspective is the tenability of these debts and deficits. Now, probably it's not a 2024 story, but at some stage I can see bond markets becoming unhinged. Maybe it's 2025, 26 story. But you've got to keep an eye on some of these structural things. And this is one of them, absolutely is one of them. I really worry about that because you can't keep piling up debt and debt in perpetuity. Now, it's true that the US dollar is the reserve currency of the world. So you go, well, what's the fallout in terms of if the US dollar falls by half, does that mean the euro has to absolutely go through the roof? And that would cripple the European economy because they can't handle it. And I'll put it in our own terms, it's like ourselves. We couldn't handle the Australian dollar going to, say, $2 against the US dollar. It would absolutely cripple our economy as well. But this is the problem of what we're dealing with. So the fallout of this in one area is these debts and deficits become more and more of a problem because you're now having to spend a lot on defence, which you previously weren't. So your defence budgets go up. Then on top of that, as you get a more fractionalised world and you work on greater degree of nationalism, That then too becomes inflationary, which puts the higher interest rate cost up. And then you can see that vicious feedback loop.
Mm.
And absolutely, in terms of with this populism, you start to bring in scope for, and fingers crossed, scope for other conflicts to escalate. And I think a lot of us are well aware of there are tensions. You are seeing a bit of naval buildup in other pockets around the globe.
Sure, we haven't heard much about the South China Sea in media. They seem to have been distracted by other topics, but yep, there seems to be plenty to be worried about if you want to go and look for it. So, Bridget, you know, if we talk about what's happened over the last 18 months, your outlook going forward, let's talk about, well, so what? What does that mean for portfolios in a moment? Can I get you to touch on where you believe your views and outlook differ to that of consensus within the market a bit, please?
Absolutely. So I think putting a little bit of jargon on it, it's probably fair to say the consensus view right now is for a soft landing.
Mm-hmm.
So what I mean by a soft landing, that is one whereby you do get interest rate cuts. So in the case of the US, you'd get 2 to 3 25 basis point interest rate cuts. You would get earnings growth slowing, but not to recessionary levels, and yet growth slowing. So that's called a soft landing, or some would call it sort of Goldilocks. So that's what they're expecting, and to some, that's what markets are priced for. And that, as I said to you right now, is why we're seeing, or part of why we're seeing, equity markets at all-time record highs, or most of them. Where I differ is I just think that's too cute. Monetary policy, i.e. interest rate rises, work with a lag. I'll again use the US and I'll come back to Australia in a moment. So rule of thumb in terms of the US, and this has worked over the history, and that is from the last official interest rate rise, it's 12 months between that and a recession. So in terms of the US, the last official rate interest rate rise was in July last year. So that would say to me that let's wait and see how things occur around about that June quarter of this year. And I think things will get a bit bumpy. I think what we'll see is quite a sharp contraction in the labour market in terms of, I think we will see the interest rate rises starting to bite. So I'm not saying it's going to be a nasty recession, but I think we could get a mild recession. So that's where I differ, which does mean you
US
will get...
US
recession.
Okay.
Which does mean that you will get the earnings side pulling back as growth pulls back, as consumers pull back on spending, you get the job cuts and you go in that vicious circle.
Hmm.
Then you'll get the interest rate cuts. And under that scenario, you probably get more interest rate cuts, 4 or 5, somewhere around there, assuming the inflation does pull back. So I'm not espousing to what I call the hard landing, which is the heavy duty recession. I don't think we're going there. I think inflation's pulled back enough that we've got enough interest rate cuts or ammunition in the toolkit in order to be able to re-stimulate via monetary policy. In terms of Australia is more sensitive to interest rate rises because unlike the US, it has 30-year fixed mortgage rates.
We're floating.
Absolutely. So it goes through. So what we've seen, I would argue late last year, Australia started to hurt in terms of, you've already seen it, employment data it's pulled back significantly. I'm not saying it's negative, but the rate of growth has eased back. And similarly, retail sales are a lot weaker. And talking to a lot of people in the industry, they are saying, particularly apparel, both margins, so volumes as well as prices have pulled back. So you are seeing some pain coming through.
So in terms of portfolios and asset classes, if we start with the defensive side of things, given all of those things, where are the preferences or sensitivities do you think that, you know, investors want to be thinking about?
So look, I think it needs to be in the defensive space. I think you need to be overall well balanced, but you need to have quality assets. I think that would be the, don't be going for the ritzy end. I think also Be careful on the office property space,
mm-hmm.
in terms of defensive. That's one that worries me, particularly for those of you that have got exposure into US fixed interest. Just make sure you haven't got too much exposure into those regional banks and into office properties, because I think there's still more write-downs and knock-on effect. We had a bit of a whiff, you may recall, last year with the regional banks, with SVB.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure we're fully through that. I think that's... Maybe I'd argue it's a bit of an X factor, but I wouldn't rule that totally off at all. So I think in that quality end, right across the curve, look, we still like the private debt. We think that's an area that really is benefiting from the dislocation as the banks have restructured. And if you've got the top assets within that class, we think that'll give you solid returns against the backdrop that we're seeing.
And on the growth side of things, Bridge, are there sides there that you're more favourable on in terms of equity exposure and other growth assets?
Look, absolutely. So look, our preference is to err on the side of being conservative. Don't chase the froth. Now, in terms of, we all know the Magnificent Seven, mm-hmm. US tech, NASDAQ has absolutely had a great rally. I would say, look, don't be chasing that. It's not. I don't think it's a rerun of the dot-com bubble. I'll make that quite clear, because these companies are making money, whereas the dot-com era, those companies weren't making money at all. So that's my first point. But if you just look at, say, the standard S&P 500, it's fully valued / expensive. Whereas when you start looking elsewhere and going a little bit under the bonnet, like small, mid-cap, value-type bias right around the globe, that is where we're seeing that area is not fully valued. We're seeing that in Europe. We're seeing that in the US. We're seeing that here, like the small-cap area, mid-cap area, sort of steering away from the large caps, the tech. We are seeing better value in that space.
And what about alternates and real assets?
Absolutely. We think they have a place. Again, you need to be doing your research and getting managers that absolutely knowing what they're doing and weeding out. There is, again, a bit of froth in that space. So again, it's the quality side, it's the conservative side, it's the ones that have got the nice, solid income streams. And look, just going back to what I said to you before in terms of other pockets, select parts of emerging markets I think are interesting. China is the standout one right now in the emerging market space. It is really, really quite cheap. India, I'd say to you, be careful with that one. It's a momentum market. Tends to be either expensive or fair value. It never tends to go to the cheap side. So China, I think, does look quite enticing.
And Bridget, to create a fully diversified portfolio for clients, you've often got to take them to places that they're not fully comfortable. So you talked about China. In the past, I've heard you talk about frontier markets and emerging markets. How do you encourage people to think about that so they might be able to come comfortable with that, and why it's necessary to have that in their portfolio?
Absolutely. So part of it is to look at a portfolio from a holistic or helicopter perspective. Mm-hmm. And you want to have your portfolio looking like a patchwork quilt. For those listeners now, you've probably already picked up a New Zealand accent. So what I mean by that is that month to month, quarter to quarter, I want the portfolio to look like some parts will be, you know, green, have done phenomenally well, some not as green, some perhaps a bit brown, et cetera, et cetera. So you want sort of the whole colour of the patchwork quilt. And the idea behind that is you don't want everything to behave in the same way, particularly against the backdrop that I think we're going through in the next 3 to 5 years. So you want different levers within your portfolio. So if 1 month, for example, you have, like we've just seen, tech suddenly going up 30%, you've got other levers there to work and provide a cushion against that. If we do get unexpected interest rate cuts, you've got some exposure via some duration, and that gives you an uptick there, whereas other parts may be going sideways. So you want to be able to sort of rock and roll, and I think that's the way you build a portfolio. And in terms of it's the components of it. Don't get too fixated by the individual components or the individual assets within it. You need to look at your portfolio as whole. It's almost like using another analogy in terms of, look at like the cake. You look at the whole cake. You don't look at one ingredient within it. And I think that's an important part of it, because that's going to help you to navigate through. And what you find, and David mentioned before about frontier. See, frontier is a good example. There are a lot of countries in there, but they don't correlate with mainstream markets. They don't correlate particularly well with developed market equities, and they don't correlate very well with emerging market equities. They beat to a different drum. So if you have developed market equities, say, falling 10%, they actually could rise by 20%. So that, again, was, I'm using this patchwork quilt concept, and I think that's the way to navigate. And people use the word diversification. And I say to you that overuse it. You actually want genuine diversification. What I mean by that is you just don't want to have, for example, Australia and the US equities and say, I've got a diversified portfolio. Because in reality, you don't. If Wall Street falls by 10%, the ASX is probably going to fall by similar.
That's not highly correlated, yeah. The point being that you want a great portfolio and not just a portfolio made up of great investments. It's actually how they come together that's really important. Bridget, it's been fantastic. Thank you for joining us at Inside the Rope. It's been worth the wait. We got there in the end. Thank you very much for joining us at Inside the Rope.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Inside the Rope with David Clark. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. You can connect with David by visiting codacapital.com. Any views expressed in this recording represent the personal opinions of the speaker and do not represent the view of any other party. If this recording contains reference to any financial products, that reference does not constitute advice or recommendation and may not be relied upon. Listeners in Australia are encouraged to visit www.moneysmart.gov.au to obtain information regarding financial advice and investments.